Well, hello there. Good evening. It's Martin North here from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our live stream on 21st of April 2020. Great to have you on board. So great to have so many supporting what we're doing and some new names as well. So welcome, welcome, welcome. Hope you enjoy this conversation. It's very free-flowing, but there's a bit of structure. And so what I'll do in a moment is just go through on my normal introductory slides. That includes a little bit of updated information. There's always new stuff to consider. But just to say that while I'm going through the presentation part of the show, I won't be directly looking at the chat. So if you have a question for me, hold off at the moment and ask the question a little bit later when I've made the initial part of the presentation, which perhaps will be 10 or 15 minutes, maybe slightly longer, depending on how we go. I will keep one eye on the chat as well, but I can't promise to answer any questions in the meantime. So with that introduction, we'll just go across to that. Some of you who watched last time will remember I was complaining about the software upgrade from Blackmagic not working. It was my fault. I forgot to reset the switcher afterwards. It works fine now. So there you go. Just read the instructions. It all helps, really. So just in terms of running order, this introduction, talk about the house rules briefly, just about our models. Just because there are new people coming all the time and it's important to understand how our models are working. Some key slides, updated information, a lot of new information come out today, so I want to cover some of that. And then we'll go into questions and answers, and the bulk of the show will be effectively answering questions live off the stream. And also I've got some from earlier on, and I had about 500 questions sent to me through various channels over the last few days. I've tried to crystallize them down. I have to say I may not be able to answer all of those questions today, but we can do our best. And we'll sign off typically about an hour and a half, give or take. So just in terms of house rules, I must always say this. This is not financial advice. I'm not a qualified financial advisor. I don't know your personal circumstances. So I'm not able to give you specific financial advice. If you need that, go talk to a financial advisor. This is based on my own analysis and research. And hopefully it'll help in terms of some, you know, ideas and concepts. It is not financial advice. Secondly, please play nice in the chat room. It is being moderated. Plexus is helping with that tonight. Thanks again for that. No racial slurs, please. There's a really good conversation that goes on in the chat, and I encourage that. We don't need to descend into racial slurs. Peach One, thank you, sir. Appreciate it. This is as at the 21st of April, 2020. You know, when you're watching this two or three years later, you'll know whether I was right, whether I was wrong. As I always say, who knows? Use Walk the World, at Walk the World, to get my attention. There are always many, many different conversations going on the stream, and it's quite often the case that I don't see everything that's going on the stream. But if you use Walk the World, there's a really good chance that you can get hold of me. Super Chat has been enabled, and that means that if you want to get your question there and visible, then you can use the Super Chat to do that. You can also make a contribution to DFA via the Super Chat. We don't make any money off what we do here. This is all about covering the costs of running the DFA show and all the stuff that we do. And it is greatly appreciated, and it's essential to be able to help us cover the costs of what we actually do. Now, in terms of the DFA approach, you will know, hopefully by now, if you're new, maybe not, that we actually focus on households and surveys. So we survey households, 1,000 new households each week, 52,000 in the year. That goes into our core market model with the SME. Nico, thank you very much. I had a rare win on gold shares, he said. Well done. Well, you can do it. SMEs. And also mortgage brokers, as well as other industry information that goes into our core market model. The core market model is what we use when we come to our analysis, and that goes into our presentations, it goes into our web shows, as well as doing stuff for specific clients. And that allows us to slice and dice the data all sorts of different ways. So we can look at it from a customer segment perspective, a location perspective, property perspective, lots of different dimensions, about 150 dimensions. Wayne, appreciate that. Thank you. And the point there is that you can think of this as a Rubik's Cube. You can slice it and dice it different ways to be able to see what's going on. Now, in terms of data today, the first thing to say is that RBA released their minutes, and they basically started back by saying the banks are in a strong position from a liquidity perspective. So that's reassuring. Everyone from APRA to the Reserve Bank to the government keeps saying the banks are in a really strong position. I wonder why they keep saying it. Are people asking questions about whether the banks are strong? Not sure. Second point they said was that the decline in asset prices has had a significant impact on superannuation funds. And we know there's about 960,000 people now looking to withdraw $10,000 or $20,000 out of their super. That's going to make a bit of a dent in the superannuation pot. Not a big one, but of course it's not uniformly spread. We know that there'll be some particular industries which will be particularly hit, and they're the ones that perhaps are going to have most trouble. So wouldn't be surprised to see a few superannuation funds needing to get liquidity support from the financial system through this process. Next one is that RBA said that the business balance sheets in Australia were in pretty good state, and they went on, though, to say that the potential of COVID is to create a very large shock for many businesses, particularly industries most exposed to the fall in economic activity. And I agree with that. My surveys are showing that some particular industries are really languishing at the moment. We'll touch on that a bit more later. Other industries, less so. It depends on where you are in the country and what industry you're in. They went on to say that households with mortgages have significant buffers. They keep saying that. It's based on old modelling, 3 or 4 years old. It's based on their securitisation modelling, which is myopic because it doesn't look at all loans, only those that are securitised. Nexus, thank you very much. Appreciate that. I can't answer your question just now, but I'll come back to it as soon as I can. And the point there is that household financial stress is probably significantly higher than the Reserve Bank has recognised. They're tending to use data from 2 or 3 years ago, and that data is unfortunately rather old. So they and I would have a different view of household financial stress. We'll touch on that a bit later. And the other thing they said was that risk from residential property has diminished over the course of the preceding year. They went on there to say that the risk of negative equity is definitely there, particularly in Western Australia. They quote 3% of properties in negative equity. I think that's understated based on what I'm seeing. And we've also seen some property price falls in other parts of the country now, so negative equity is beginning to rear its ugly head. And we'll see more of that ahead. Also, Lowe made a speech today, and they, for the first time, gave some initial sort of points as to what they felt the economic outlook will be post COVID. And they said the first thing is fall of output by around 10% over the first half of the year, most of the decline being in the June quarter, and the employment rate will be much higher than it would have been previously, but the job keeper is keeping a lid on it. Secondly, the year-ended headline inflation will turn negative in June, and that of course is pretty unusual because normally inflation is up a little bit. Remember, the Reserve Bank has a target of 2-3% inflation, so completely off the wall with what's actually happening. And then they all went on to say that our banks are rightly acting as a shock absorber and helping the country through this difficult period. And in a way, what's happening, of course, is that banks are providing lending to households and to some businesses to help them through the shock. But it's actually not uniform. There are many people who've contacted me and said they've been unable to get the support that they wanted. And others in the business sector who've said, well, they will give it to me, but the cost is huge. And of course, that's the tricky thing. If you're a business, you've got to try and figure out whether, in fact, you want to borrow more to see through the next however many months this is going to be or not. They're also saying that the economy will bounce back. They always say that. Of course, the RBA is always half glass full. Growth will be very strong next year, with GDP growth 6-7%. Following a fall of around 6% this year, so a deep dip and then a return. But of course, they're talking about next year, not this year. So, you know, this is not going to be something which is going to be all over by June. And then they also make the point that it's harder to forecast the unemployment rate, but it looks as though the unemployment rate will remain above 6% over the next couple of years. So just pause on that. We had an unemployment rate at 5.1 and 5.2 before all of this. We're going to see it rise perhaps up to 10% or maybe slightly more. They're saying it's going to come back down, but it will still be quite a lot higher. And that tells you, and it should tell you, it tells me, that this is going to be something which is going to be with us for a long, long period of time. So no V-shaped recovery here. And the other point that they make finally was that, well, it might be quicker, it might be slower, we're not sure, because we've got to deal with the virus, we've got to actually contain the virus. If we can do it more quickly, then that's good. But if it takes another length of time, or if it actually comes back again, then that's going to have a more pronounced impact and a longer impact. So there you go, that's the RBA's potted view of what's going on. I have to say, no great insights there, but it is interesting just to see how they're thinking. Now, one point it's worth noting is the bank bill swap rate. This is effectively the cost of funds to the banks, and the RBA made the point that it's close to zero now. So because of what they've been doing in terms of their open market operations, the three-month funding rate is close to zero. So in other words, banks can get funds very, very cheaply to lend, which means they should be able to lend very, very cheaply. I have to say that I've noticed quite a few, though, that they actually don't offer very, very cheap loans. So the loans are still quite expensive. So the banks are making a margin between the cost of funds and what they're charging people. And I think that's something which the ACCC should be looking at, because I think that's a bit unfair. Now, just standing back, the G10 central banks' balance sheets grew by $2.7 trillion, and two-thirds of that was with the Fed over the last month or so. Massive amount. And that equates to more than $23 trillion if it went on for a full year. This is actually from Deutsche Bank. And what's quite interesting here is that the growth in balance sheets around the world is, of course, because most of the central banks are doing the same thing, in other words, throwing liquidity at it. But the point there is also, and they made this point, that if QE is going to be continued, it indicates that actually central banks are out of ideas, and we could actually end up with a Japanization, in other words, a deflation of global economies rather than inflation. And we'll come back to that a bit later, because this actually becomes a very important question with regard to, for example, gold. Is gold going to go up? Is it going to go down? Fundamentally, it's about inflation or deflation. And a lot of people are thinking inflation, but I'm not quite so convinced at the moment. And oil, well, you know, you would have seen in the chat there was a discussion about oil. The May contract went negative, strongly negative, more than $30 negative, simply because nobody wants oil at the moment. The next contract, the CL2, was actually for June delivery, still sitting up around 20. So it's a very, little blip, really, but it's quite an important blip. And the other point that Bloomberg made was that in real terms, oil is its cheapest since 1971. So since the end of Bretton Woods, oil has outstripped inflation until now. And this is pretty remarkable. The fact is that nobody's, well, some people are, but not many people are burning oil. And so there's questions of where to store it, how to store it. My own view is there's an opportunity for Australia to build a strategic oil reserve. We have a very low level of reserve onshore here. And if I were ScoMo, I'd be using the opportunity of these low prices to bring a lot of oil into Australia and store it on shore, so we've got 90 days rather than 30 days. But maybe that's too straightforward a strategy, but that's what I would be doing. Now, the other point to make is this virus. There's a really interesting chart that talks about the do-nothing strategy and a massive increase in infections. If you start mitigating, then you begin to actually bring the infections down. If you tighten up and basically do the lockdown, you can actually bring the infection rate down. Then the question is, what do you do after that? And the fourth stage, they call it the dance. In other words, how do you keep R, the infection rates, below one? And that's really the tricky part. And the danger is that if you don't actually keep things tight enough, you then start to see essentially a rise. Inbar, thank you very much. Really appreciate that. So the problem we've got is that the example of Singapore, where they were actually pretty good for a long period of time, started to open the taps a little, and then suddenly there's a massive spike. That's the danger. And so you may have seen the conversation I had with John Adams on the interests of the people, where John was arguing for a quick opening of the taps, as it were. Now, let the virus rip a bit because we need the economic activity. I'm arguing that we are where we are. We've actually got pretty much under control now, and we don't want to give up on that control. And it may mean keeping the economy throttled for a little bit longer. But if we can do that, there's a chance, both in Australia and in New Zealand, we can actually get to zero. In other words, we could actually, within our geographic boundaries, have no live infections. Now, that would still require us to have boundaries on the borders, and international travel would definitely still be off limits for quite some time. But that would be a way of dealing with this in a way, potentially, that allows more freedom later. The other way of doing it is to open the throttle a little bit and see some infections and then turn it down a little bit and try and control the infections down again, which is a bit what Singapore and other people are trying to do. But it's quite tricky, and there's a delay, of course, of about 3 weeks. So you open the throttle, then you suddenly see a spike, you have to turn it down again. Tricky. And so remember, there is no vaccine that's been identified yet. There's about 70 or 80 candidates, but they're in early stages. But SARS, they never found a vaccine. And this particular virus is close to SARS. And the other point to make there is that, you know, nobody quite knows what the true transmission rates are and the true infection rates, because we're not sure how many people in the community are asymptomatic. That's part of the problem with testing. So you have to get testing right. You have to be able to do track and trace very quickly. And you also have to keep the throttle, you know, relatively tight to keep this under control, which is why my belief is that the economy is going to be in some difficulty, not just for the next 2 months or 3 months, but it's going to be certainly through this year and probably into next year. And by the way, I've got two big reservations about that tracking app. Now, the banks have hardly drawn down on the TFF. That's the term funding facility that the RBA launched. It was a $90 billion fund that the banks could tap into if they wanted to. In fact, what's happened is that banks have tended to grab deposits because there are still people with money, and they're actually putting a lot more money into term deposits in the banks at the moment. So effectively, the banks have been able to support their books through that. And so they've only taken down about $2.4 billion so far of the $90 billion. There'll be probably more use of that later. But nevertheless, the fact of the matter is that many people are actually putting money in the banks, which is helping the banks out. Now, Reserve Bank of New Zealand announced today that they were going to reduce the loan-to-value limits for mortgages. So they put some limits in place to control high LVR lending. But because the concern now is that home prices might slide, they've taken those limits away, certainly temporarily. And so they wrote a letter to the lending organisations in New Zealand. I think it's a bit nuts, actually, because essentially at a time when, you know, there's risk in the system, you want to actually be more conservative in your lending, not actually be more aggressive. But, of course, the Reserve Bank is trying to support the economy in New Zealand, and they're trying to get people to borrow. So it's all part of that same narrative. And I wouldn't be surprised to see similar things here in Australia. Now, Roy Morgan said today that the consumer confidence had actually bounced back a little bit further. So this is the third week in a row now since its dip. And they're hypothesizing this is because, you know, there's a little bit more better news about the virus and a little bit better news about where we're heading. But interestingly, the inflation expectation has dropped dramatically. So they said it's dropped by another 3.1%. So in other words, people have very little view as to the fact that there's going to be any inflationary pressures later, which is quite interesting. But the confidence is still very, very low. So it's still well below where it was back in 2008 and 9. And also we're seeing now more lenders tightening their serviceability rules. NAB's come out and basically said that they're going to require new serviceability assessments. They're looking specifically to get more information about borrowers and to make sure that the serviceability is okay. And there's a quote there from homeloanexperts.com to say a mortgage approval is no longer as certain because than it was before the pandemic. Borrowers shouldn't assume that the lender will honour their pre-approval when they find a property. We're seeing a lot of people disappointed. They basically got a pre-approval, went to get a property, and then discovered that the bank said, no, we're not lending anymore. And there have been a number of stories that have come across my desk. So we're going to see, I think, lending tightening. and that's going to be a significant issue. Now, I've showed you this chart 2 weeks ago, but just to update those who didn't see that, household financial confidence crashed again, 73.2. This is looking at it in terms of income, expenditure, job security, mortgage, and the value of property. But the critical thing is job security went through the floor. So a lot of people suddenly felt very insecure. And of course, if you're insecure with a job, you're not going to spend as much. So that's not surprising that we're seeing it drop. And it dropped not just for mortgage owners and renters, but also for even those without any mortgage who also had a tricky ride on the stock market over the last month or so. Mortgage stress also jumped up. It was 32% a month ago. It's now 37.2% in March. That's another 200,000 people. We look at it on a cash flow basis. So a lot of people are struggling with mortgage repayments. And that's where I depart from the Reserve Bank, because my data shows me that households are really struggling with their financials before the virus hit. And now it's just continuing to go the same way. So that's a big deal. Now, I've done some specific modelling on the impact of COVID. We've put some new questions in our survey, specifically asking about whether households have been impacted financially, and also more broadly, what other impacts this has had on them. And the first headline finding here is that 36% of households are now reporting that they have been impacted financially, and it's rising quite fast. And interestingly, that's an average. And you can see here that I've shown it by different industries. So, for example, those in the legal profession are less impacted, whereas those in production and assembly or in retail are more impacted. And even those in education and training, and of course that's partly the university sector and also schools, they're also quite badly impacted too. And that financial impact can be loss of income, it can be loss of job, or it can be other costs relating to, the financial fallout. But that's a pretty worrying number. And it's been going up by about 6% a week over the last 2 or 3 weeks. So I would suspect that next week it'll be, above 40%. We'll report it again. We also can look at this from a JobKeeper perspective. This has come out today from Grattan. And they said that more than 838,000 applications have been submitted for the federal government's JobKeeper program. Early data suggests the money will flow to the businesses and workers that need it most. One of the sectors hardest hit by the downturn is the arts and recreational services. Others include education and training and accommodation and food services. And it's interesting, the reason it's more than 100% is that you can apply as an individual and also as a business as well. So that's why it's above 100. And you can see there the industry distribution is pretty remarkably stretched in some areas and less stretched in other areas. So it does depend which part of the industry collection you're actually in as to what your financial outlook might be and your job prospects. But JobKeeper is definitely hitting a lot of people. And of course, that's keeping the unemployment number down. So without JobKeeper, there would have been a much bigger unemployment number. A lot of people were thinking 17%. Many people are now thinking it's going to be around 10%. It could be a bit more than 10% at the peak. That's still a big number, but it might be a little bit. Might be a little bit different. Okay, now in terms of the residential status, this is quite interesting. So, if you were renting, then you're nearly 60% likely to have a financial impact relating to COVID. If you're a property owner, it's just over 22%. If you're in another status, for example, if you're living with family or friends or whatever, it's a bit lower. But that's quite significant. So we know a lot of renters are really struggling. And for those with mortgages, if you have a mortgage, then you're more than 25% likely to be impacted financially relating to COVID. Whereas if you had no mortgage, it's about 18%. So that's, again, quite an interesting difference. And I just wanted to show the interest income distribution here. So if you are on low income, so this is 0 to 50, 50 to 100, 500 to 150, about half of those between 0 and 50 are impacted, and about a third of those between 50 and 100,000 are impacted. So unfortunately, it's low-paid workers who are disproportionately being impacted by the COVID. And interestingly, a lot of those are on gig contracts, part-time contracts, short-term contracts. that may not be able to access some of those government support processes that are available. And Grattan published this chart quite recently, I spoke about it yesterday, again showing that the proportion of people on lower incomes is essentially more impacted than those on higher levels of income. A different lens, but it's just showing that there's a commonality to the research there. By states, it's highest in New South Wales, so 40% of households in New South Wales are impacted financially from COVID. It's slightly lower in Victoria, but it's lowest of all in the Northern Territories. And you can see that the average is 36, so that's the way that works. And just some broader drivers. So we asked about impact of home care, impact of income reduction, job loss. And interestingly, there's more job loss amongst mortgage status mortgaged households. In other words, if you've got a mortgage, you're 27, 28% likely to be financially impacted because of job loss, and about 23% with regard to income reduction. Those are big numbers. There's slight variations between the mortgage status, no mortgage, and mortgage status mortgaged. So unfortunately, if you have a mortgage, you've got a greater chance of being badly impacted by this. Now, one way of looking at this is to go down to postcode level. As you know, my postcode level data allows me to really drill into where the pressures are. So this is just a stack ranked chart that highlights the number of households in a particular postcode with a financial impact of COVID based on information to the 20th of April. So the one at the top is 4350 Toowoomba, followed by 4740 Mackay and 4670 Bundaberg. So three Queensland postcodes. So that's quite interesting. Wouldn't have expected that, but that's what this is showing me, that in fact the greatest number of people being impacted are actually not necessarily in Sydney and Melbourne, but actually is up in Queensland. Then we've got Liverpool, 2170, Mandurah over in the west at 6210. Mandurah unfortunately keeps popping up in the dispatches. Werribee, 3030, Cranbourne, 3977. Some of those you'll recognise, those who follow my mortgage stress stuff, because those are households with a lot of mortgage stress as well, unfortunately. And you can see there, you can get down the list, Westmead, 2145, Cairns, 4870, Gosford, so up in Central Coast, 2250, on the Gold Coast, 4217, Ipswich, west of Brisbane, 4305, 3029, Hoppers Crossing, 4551, Sunshine Coast, and 4655, Hervey Bay, and you can see the others there. So that shows you that there are particular hotspots. And another way of looking at those hotspots is to look at my mapping. Now, this is something you won't be able to see the detail. I will make these charts available on the DFA blog so that you can actually download them and look at them in more detail later. But this is just the number of households by postcode in Sydney. And you can see that there are a couple of hotspots in Western Sydney where we've got a greater proportion on account basis of people being impacted by COVID. And you can also look at it by the percentage of households. So there's always a debate, do you show percentages or do you show the total count? And interestingly, if you look at the percentage of households in a particular postcode, then we've actually got more people down the east coast areas of Sydney than shown on the previous one, which was just the absolute number. So in some postcodes, there might be a smaller number of people living in those postcodes, but in fact, some of the more affluent postcodes down the east coast there are already now experiencing significant financial impacts. And it's a bit the same if you look in Melbourne. So again, you know, it's like Werribee and around their areas and down towards Dandenong and Frankston. Again, big numbers. But if you look at that in terms of the percentage, again, you can see a different variation. Some areas in Melbourne where there's a percentage that's quite high, as well as areas in the outlying parts of Melbourne as well. And you can see the same if you go to Brisbane, where effectively you've got Ipswich with a very large concentration of people with significant impact from COVID. Other areas around the outskirts as well, down towards the Gold Coast and up towards Moreton Bay. But then if you go to the percentage of households, again, you start seeing a greater proportion of households closer into Brisbane that actually are now impacted. So it's giving you quite an interesting difference between the total number and the percentage in a house in a particular postcode. And we can do the same with Hobart, obviously less numbers. simply because there's less population there. But again, there's a little bit of a distribution question between different parts of Hobart. And we can do the same in Adelaide as well. And again, you can see that there's a little bit of concentration around the edge. The blue is low levels. The more intense colours are higher. But if you look at the percentage of households, then you've got a different story. There's one or two close in to Adelaide where there is actually quite a high proportion of people in difficulty. And then we just go to Perth to finish this off. And again, you can see that, like Wanneroo, north of Perth there, we've got some issues there and down south in terms of the number of households impacted. And that's partly to do with the high density population that we've got there. And then we've got the proportion of households. And again, you can see some slight differences down south and out there. So it gives you a bit of a flavour as to where the hot spots are with regards to COVID and the financial impact. And there is a really interesting observation here, because there are strong correlations between the mortgage stress, risk of mortgage default, and the impact of COVID. Unfortunately, quite a few of those households already in difficulty are now precisely the ones being hit over the head with the virus, unfortunately. Now, just to finish this presentation, I'll just update the scenarios. Just to explain, we run the scenarios off the back of our model. So as we update the model, we update our scenarios. Not a lot has changed, but essentially we have still got our global disruption scenario as the one that we think is most likely to be the true situation. We've given it now a 65% rating, so it's become even stronger in terms of our view. We've increased the unemployment rate over the next 24 months to between 9.5% and 11%, so we don't think it's going to come down as quickly as the Reserve Bank. And the bank losses are considerably higher than previously. There were sitting at sort of 30, 35 previously. Now it's 45 basis points. That's because of what we're seeing with regards to some of the issues that we're following already with households struggling. And by the way, we also update if it's uncontrolled. In other words, if you actually let it rip, then we start to see even more significant house price falls, down 80%. But we also see high bank losses. So we don't want to go there. This is pretty much the best case that we've got at the moment. It's unlikely we're going to have just a local crunch, and we're certainly not going to have a short-term wonder. You know, that's pretty much impossible now. So this is going to be, I think, our central case going forward. And unfortunately, it means that quite a few people are going to have significant issues with mortgage stress, with high levels of unemployment, and therefore the banks are going to be hit as well. Okay, so that's pretty much where we are. Now let me just come back to my main camera, and I'm just going to look back. Now there was a question that was asked early on. Let me see where I can find that. Where was it? Trying to find the questions. Okay. Nenos asked, should I sell my investment properties if they are paying them off on a weekly basis? What should you do if you're in my position? Well, the question is, why are you in investment, right? So if investment properties are there for future capital appreciation, I think you probably forget it. If you have sufficient cash flow coming in at the moment, you've got people in those properties, and essentially when you do the calculations, you've got sufficient coming in terms of rentals to cover the costs and repayment of the mortgage and those sorts of things. In other words, if your business is cash flow positive, then it's probably okay. Unfortunately, many people, when they sit down and do the calculations on the investment property without capital appreciation, are actually losing money. And that's why we're seeing about 8% of properties in the investment sector now coming on the market. So there's significantly higher listings than previously from investment property sectors. Also, quite a few people were using Airbnb. They can't do that anymore because, of course, that's now not a feasible proposition. And that was another reason why many people are struggling. So you've got to do the math, but you probably shouldn't assume that there's going to be any further capital appreciation. And if you've got capital appreciation in your property now, in other words, you bought it 8 years ago and it's gone up, and you're not making a huge amount in terms of rental, it might be worth considering getting rid of it. Okay. Let's see what else we've got in terms of questions. I'm just looking back over the charts, and there's a lot of different conversations on, which is great. Questions. Okay, so this is from Nish. What are the chances that I could get contacted for one of your surveys? Is there any particular criteria that I need to be satisfied? Well, the way it works is I don't do the surveys. So it's done by one of the big agencies. It's done as part of what's called an omnibus survey. So they ask a bunch of different questions, and they never disclose that it's for DFA. It's never disclosed that it's Martin North asking the questions. And it's a what's called a branching questionnaire. So basically, depending on where you are and what your answers are, you won't necessarily be asked all the questions. So that's the way it works. I have no influence about the way that the candidates are selected. It's done over the phone. But the agency has a very powerful computer algorithm that allows people in the call centres there, and they're still working, you know, in the call centres even now, to be able to actually call statistically optimised people so that each week I get a mini version of the ABS census, as it were. That's the way it works. So, no, unfortunately, there's no direct way to interact. I've had a few people ask over the years, you know, could they do the survey just out of their own interest? And something which I might think about. The problem is that if I make it available to you know, DFA viewers, they're going to be a self-selecting sample, and therefore, statistically speaking, it will not be helpful, right? Because the whole point about the DFA survey method is that it actually is deliberately to be statistically robust, meaning that it absolutely maps to the ABS census distribution in terms of age, postcode distribution, and other attributes. So that's the way it works. Okay. So CDL says, what will be the impact of RBA QE on Main Street? Japan has been doing it since the 90s and is still operating the economy. Good question. Look, there's a big, let's have this debate now. There's a big discussion to be had. Do you think that what's happening is going to create raging inflation later, or is it going to be recessionary deflation? That's really the question. And there are more people who are arguing that with the amount of QE that's going on around the world, in Australia and you know, in the US particularly, the Fed with its massive stimulus measures, $2.1 trillion in the last month or so, that it's going to potentially create raging inflation later. Now, I sort of understand why people make that argument, but I have to tell you that Japan is a really interesting case where they've been at this longer. They've been doing a lot of QE. They've been buying all sorts of assets, including stocks and bonds. And yet the central bank there now owns a larger, you know, almost a larger proportion of the stock market than anybody else in the world. And they've still got deflation rather than inflation. Look at property prices in Japan. They've gone nowhere. So the worry I have is that we could well be entering a deflationary, stagflationary environment. In other words, basically no growth. No growth in incomes, no growth in economic output, no growth in GDP. It could be actually depressionary. And if that's the case, then it starts effectively a negative spiral, and that then starts to reduce the value of assets. And that includes home price falls, that includes stock market falls, and that includes potentially gold prices falling as well. And where I stand is that I don't know which way this is going to go, but I'm probably more convinced than some people of a deflationary future rather than an inflationary future. And that's one of the reasons why I've tended to avoid gold, because gold performs really well in an inflationary environment. It's a protection, basically. You know, it keeps your value and it rises in line or better than inflation. And that was certainly true in the 70s and the 80s. Not necessarily true, though, in the deflation environment. And that's why you've got such a divergence of people. There are some people who are claiming that gold is going to the moon. I've seen some of those people, and they keep writing to me saying, how can you be so negative on gold? You know, it's going to go wherever. But there are also people who say, no, it could be deflationary. And, of course, Harry Dent's one example. I've interviewed Harry a couple of times, and he's still saying $700, $800 is where he thinks gold will be eventually. Not in the short term, so it'll probably go up a bit. So in the short term, it might be a bit of a haven. But nevertheless, long term, if deflation flows through, then effectively it means that all asset classes, also means that home prices won't go up. It means that we'll revert to our long term means. And remember, home prices in Australia are 40% above neutral value at the moment. So there's plenty of downside risk on home prices. And I've been saying this for some time, as you may know. Channel 9 quoted me a couple of years ago on 60 Minutes when I said one of the scenarios could be a 40% drop. Well, guess what? One of the scenarios could be a 40% drop. I still think I'm right on that. So that's really what I'm thinking about the future. So inflation, deflation, who knows? We will have a chance, I think, to get a read in 6 to 12 months' time as to which way this starts to go. If we start seeing inflation, the risk, though, then is that we start seeing interest rates rise. And if interest rates start to rise, that's going to put significant pressure on households with large mortgages. In Australia, we've got lots of people with large mortgages. And that's going to put significant downwards pressure then on growth. So whichever way you look at this, I'm very negative on future economic growth. I think it's going to be very unlikely that we're going to see growth in the threes or the fours or more, simply because of the journey that we've been through. But, you know, I could be wrong, but we'll watch. Now, Jeff says, working in the ED mental health, I'm worried about the suicide rate, the social costs of COVID. You're absolutely right. This is a devil of a problem that we've got, right? Because there are clearly impacts on throttling back the economy and keeping people in their homes. You know, domestic violence and mental health issues, et cetera, et cetera. And the government has actually put some money into mental health, probably not enough. And yet, if we don't deal with the virus and if we don't actually stamp it out, this thing could rage for months or even years. As I said earlier on, unless there's a vaccine, and, you know, there's no guarantee there'll be a vaccine, this could just keep coming and coming. And, you know, it's a very aggressive virus and it can unfortunately kill not just old people, but other people too. Rather randomly, you know, it's something like 20% of people who get hit with the virus has significant symptoms. About 5% or a quarter of those actually end up in, you know, intensive care. So you could easily swamp the health service again, and you could easily have a lot of people in deep difficulty. And that's what we've seen in a number of countries where we've had effectively second order increases, like in Singapore and even in South Korea, for example, as well. So I'm sort of with you, Jeff, insofar that, you know, it is horrible to say, but we have to get this health thing fixed. And that means, I think, being patient and holding the economy, you know, in its current relatively frozen state. Although, of course, here we do have some sectors of the economy still working. It's not like everything is frozen, unlike some other places. And, of course, in New Zealand, they've now announced they're going to ratchet it back from 4 to 3, giving a little bit more momentum. But the trouble is, there's a lag. So if you start opening the throttles and then you start effectively getting inflation, getting infections, you won't necessarily know for 3 or 4 weeks, and by which time there'll be a massive hike. It takes another 3 or 4 weeks to start throttling it down again. So that's that chart I was trying to show earlier on. But it's a devil of a problem. It really is. Okay. Missed that one. Okay, this is from Richard. So to confirm your scenario analysis, with a 65% chance of a 40% house price fall, is that predicated on an economy-wide deflation or stagflation scenario? Okay, so this is essentially expecting that we will have a deflationary scenario over the next couple of years. There may well be inflation later, but beyond my 2 to 3 year horizon. So that's basically what I've assumed in my modelling. And it's because I cannot see a V-shaped recovery from this for the reasons I've explained. And I think that it will take quite some time to be able to actually turn the economy back around. I doubt that we will ever get back to the levels of growth that we had earlier on. I think that the international trade structure has been fundamentally changed. I think that our ability to do some of the things we did previously has pretty much gone. And we were also very fortunate thanks to the very high level of demands from China, which may not be there again. So that's some of the reasons why I think it's going to be deflationary. Will I be paying pennies for a loaf of bread in a deflationary recession, says Thomas. Well, that's the point. You see, you end up essentially with goods and services becoming cheaper because effectively people, one, don't have the money, and two, as prices come down, then effectively the value goes down, and so it spirals down. And it's very hard to get out of, unfortunately. So quite often what you'll find is that there is a quite long, protracted period of deflation with wages falling, with people unable to buy what they want. Therefore, prices are cut to try and actually, you know, sell some things. The quality of goods often goes down in that environment. More people often go into the unemployment queues, unfortunately, in that environment too. So there's a whole set of negative feedback loops that start to come through. You often find there are high levels of default on mortgages and things as well, unfortunately. It's just all part of that cycle. So that's what I fear. So Cookie Boy said, I posted on Twitter yesterday that this was cashing in. Who was? Somebody was cashing in on their gold, as both of us have been saying for a while that cash is king. Oh, I see. Yeah, well, I told you, I think some time ago, I went to cash some time back because my belief was that you could not actually guarantee that stocks would actually hold their value. They look to me to be falling again now, and they probably will fall further. Bonds unlikely to go up very much for all sorts of reasons. Gold, well, I've explained my issue with gold, and just going on the Bitcoin trip again, somebody asked earlier on about Bitcoin. You don't know what that Bitcoin is worth. There's a halving coming up. Nobody knows whether that's going to increase the value or not. It's been languishing somewhat recently. There really is no underlying value attached to Bitcoin. It's all based on market sentiment at the moment. Sentiment's more negative than positive. Although I still read many people, often from the Bitcoin community, who actually argue there's a huge upside. So my view is, if you want to risk money on an upside opportunity, do it. But it's a speculation. There is no fundamental value linked to Bitcoin. It is a speculation. And as long as you understand that it's a bet, might go up, might go down, might go sideways, might disappear completely. And if you can afford to lose it, great. And if you make money, fantastic. Okay, let's have a look. What else have we got? Pranny says, very informative. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. It's, what I'm trying to do here is give you my opinion, but also share some facts so that you can make your own opinions, right? I don't believe that I should be spoon-feeding a particular answer, but what I am trying to do is to give people a context to be able to actually hopefully make better decisions. Dingo says, 30 years ago, couldn't buy property in Japan. Now I can't give it away. Yeah, look at the property values in Japan in real terms. They've dropped dramatically. And there's no end in sight to that, interestingly. So I think that's a good illustration of potentially what could happen here. Now, next question says, do you expect the government or the RBA to take any actions that may prevent house prices dropping? They'll try. I'm sure that we'll get another first-time buyer incentive scheme of some sort. I've interviewed now a few people through my surveys who took that 95% scheme. And in each case, the value of the property has now dropped already. So they've lost the 5% equity they had. And of course, this is what I was saying a few months ago, was that if you only go into a property transaction with 5% equity and you see property prices drop, you lose your equity first. That's just the way it works. Now, if you're going to hold that property for a long period of time, let's say 10 years, you might do okay. But in the short term, it's quite disconcerting when you see your hard-earned cash disappearing. The government then guarantees the next 15%, the bank beyond that. Okay, Joanne says, do you think house prices, when do you think the house price trough will be? The last quarter of this year, perhaps, after the six-month mortgage freeze ends, or not until 2021? I think that they won't be able to turn off the mortgage freeze and the other government stimulus in September. They'll have to at least taper it off. My own modelling is at the moment assuming it'll be tapered through to the end of the year, which means that next year will be the big move down in property prices. We'll also see at that point how many people are being forced to sell because essentially they won't be able to service their mortgages, and we'll know what the unemployment rate is. So I think we're probably looking at 12 to 18 months out from here. And James says, if we go into a deflationary environment in Australia with gold, stocks and housing going down, would you recommend that cash is king and just hold Aussie dollars? And he says, thanks for all your great content. You're welcome. Yeah, so, I mean, my own strategy has been to hold cash, and a lot of that is in Aussie dollars. I do hold a little bit of foreign currency too, because I actually believe that the chances are that we will depreciate against the US and the pound sterling. Pound sterling looks a little bit more sick now than I hoped it would, but, you know, we'll see. But the bulk of my holdings are still in Aussie dollars because that's where I live. And I'm just really been holding it, you know, waiting to see what happens, because there are too many uncertain. I'm not going back into the stock market at the moment. There are too many ups and downs. It's a lottery, frankly. And most of the other asset classes that you could invest in also have risks, including property. So that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. Okay. Pranny says, your views on where all the QE money will end up. Do you see any upside to other commodities like silver? Well, silver's going to follow gold, I suspect. And I know that there are some people who are, you know, silver advocates and believe that's where the future will be. And if in an inflationary environment, it might well be. But it goes back to, do you think we're going to get inflation or deflation? If you're going to get deflation, then silver's going to go the same way as gold, any more so. And that's the problem. So all this QE that we're talking about is flowing back into the financial system, and it's actually supporting the profits of corporates, and it's supporting the profits of the banks. It's not necessarily flowing directly into other assets at the moment. So that's something else to bear in mind. Okay, let's have a look. What else have we got? And Cookie says, looks like more people will be working from home after this pandemic. What happened to commercial? Yeah, well, I'm already seeing horrible things happening in the commercial sector. So retail was already looking pretty sick. So there are lots of vacant retail units around the place. Many of them, of course, were built as ground floors of apartment blocks, for example. Many of them never actually got occupied at all. I'm also very concerned about some of those commercial property trusts who've suddenly found that those rental streams have disappeared. And what that means is that we've got a surfeit of commercial property. Now, some of that traditionally might get converted to residential, but then we've got too much residential stuff and there's not less demand now with migration going to zero. So, yeah, I think the commercial property sector is in for a real bath. I think the retail will be the first part of it. I think offices will also never be the same again, because people have now started to wake up to the fact they can work from home and that the technology is strong enough to be able, well, in most cases, if you're on NBN, yes, less so perhaps if you're not. If you're in regional areas, probably not. But, I'm running NBN here tonight. We're running fibre to the property here, and we're being able to get 90 down and 40 up. So works well for this. So, you know, it is feasible to do that. So I think we're going to see more people working at home. I also think that it fundamentally changes the mode of operation about way businesses work and what's possible. And I wouldn't be surprised to see more of that. So I think commercial property is going to look pretty worrisome for quite some time. Greg asks, politically, do you see any point of difference between ALP and the Lib Nats in this crisis, and also the US Dem and Republicans? He said, Republican egomaniacs. Look, I've got the view, and I've had this view for some time, that both large parties here and over there in the US are predominantly on the same side of politics. They are basically still supportive of the same financial structures, you know, big banks, all those things. And there's a lot of lip service about workers versus some business. But in fact, push comes to shove. If you look at what they actually do, the ALP, for example, they tend to fall in behind the government ultimately after making a bit of a fuss. So there isn't a real divergency of policy, in my view, unfortunately. We've got ourselves in the common denominator bucket. And it's basically neoliberalism, which basically says we want to use debt, we're going to pump up the economy, we're going to get households to spend more, we're going to get businesses to invest more, we will actually take taxes for business down, and we will actually make households pay more. That's pretty much both sides of policy, I think. And of course, last time around, the ALP had a more radical policy, and it was thrown out, which makes them, I think, even more likely to follow the other side of politics. And particularly now, there's almost no differentiation. I was quite disappointed that the ALP wasn't more vociferous with regard to some of the recent developments. And I think there should be a much stronger debate going on about where do we go from here. You know, the debate about do we try to get to zero over the next month or so, or do we ratchet it up? But, you know, ALP is pretty silent on that at the moment. And I'm seeing in the US both sides there pretty much on the same page as well. So unfortunately, there's no real policy differentiation, I don't think. Narif asked, and again, I'm not sure whether I've answered this, following up my earlier response, do you think the government and the RBA might be successful in preventing house price drops through efforts? No, they've only got a limited armory. I mean, they can throw money at the banks and the banks can be persuaded to lend, I guess. We can find more first buyer schemes. We might even see stamp duty being abolished. I know that New South Wales is suggesting this and replacing it with land tax to try and make the transactions easier and more effective than previously. But all of that is rather limited, particularly when you don't have strong demand. So think about the demand levers we used to have. There was strong migration. Migration was 300,000 a year for the last few years, gone now. We had a lot of property investors buying in, and one-third of all property owners were investors. That stopped now. We have first-time buyers who were a bit active, but there's a relatively small number of them, and now they're getting quite concerned and nervous because of what's happening with the income. And you've got, who else? Well, you've got a few people wanting to trade up, and you've got a lot of people wanting to trade down. Put all that together, and those economic dynamics would suggest to me that we're going to see probably a fall in home prices and a fall in momentum. And whilst the government will try to do stuff, I don't know that they will be successful. And my concern is if they are successful, remember we've got very, very high debt at the moment, and we've already been seeing the implications of this high debt in terms of failure rates and all those things. If the solution is make people borrow even more, I find that a very worrisome conclusion to this whole journey. So, yeah, that's my own view. Dog23, thank you so much. Really appreciate that. Now, this is from Blistering Barnacles, Hergé, do you have any thoughts on long volatility funds and trends and trend following funds or global macro funds? Haven't looked at those in great detail. You might want to go and talk to look at what Nucleus Wealth have been talking about, because they've been doing a little bit of work on those at the moment. There is some evidence that in the long term, some of those can do reasonably well, but of course they tend to track indices, and the question is what can happen to indices. So I really haven't looked in great detail, so I'm not really going to be able to give you much on that. Now, Maria has asked, is our money safe in the banks? Do you think we could still have a bail-in? If no, why not? Okay, good question. A lot of people have asked about bail-in. So as you know, I was always concerned about the risk of APRA effectively grabbing deposits and recapitalising banks in a crisis. Now, three things have happened. The first is that the RBA and the financial system has been absolutely supported by all the processes that have been put in place. The banks now can hold less capital. The banks can effectively not report bad loans for at least 6 months. That could be extended. So there's a bunch of reasons why the banks are essentially now in a stronger position, partly because of support from the RBA and elsewhere. Also, the fact that they are now being encouraged not to pay dividends. So APRA's come out and said, look, consider not paying dividends, and so there's now a sort of an expectation that banks will pay low dividends or no dividends, so that will keep more capital in the banks. There will be some losses from property, that's quite clear, but I think those losses will be slow. And my own reading of what's going on at the moment is that the way that this is being handled is through these interest repayment holidays and capital repayment holidays in some cases. And APRA is now, you know, given the banks a bit of a free pass. ASIC has too, insofar that they've said that people can now go back to interest-only loans, which means they can pay less. So all of those things would suggest to me that the banks are going to be in a more stable environment than I expected a few months ago. Second point, of course, is we've still got the deposit scheme, and I had a number of questions beforehand about the deposit scheme. 250k per account brand is the amount of insurance on deposits. So, for example, if you have St. George and Westpac, that's still counted as one brand, so you don't get 250 twice. The other important point to note there is there's about a 20 billion sort of cap for each financial institution, so it's not necessarily unlimited. But it's only triggered when the government triggers it, and they haven't triggered it so far. So it's a theoretical guarantee, but it is there. And it was really designed for a situation where a single entity got into difficulty. Where we are now is we've got effectively a systemic structural issue in the finance sector. And therefore, it's more likely that we're going to see the bailouts from government or from the Reserve Bank or through the Committed Liquidity Facility rather than bail-in of deposits. So I'm actually in Australia much more convinced that, in fact, deposits are safe in the banking system than I was a few months ago. But I always say spread it around multiple organisations, keep it below the 250k. That's just, you know, makes a lot of sense. In New Zealand, they've still got the open banking resolution stuff there, and there is a much more explicit deposit bail-in structure in New Zealand. But again, in New Zealand, the Reserve Bank in New Zealand has actually also provided much more support to the banks than I expected. So, you know, the strategy has been, never mind the real economy, let's support the banking system, let's support the people in and around the banking system, and let the banks then lend to customers and businesses. That's how this is being developed. The Fed's doing something similar. And you might want to watch my show today with George Gammon, because George and I discuss specifically what the Fed has been doing and how the Fed's strategy is basically to support the financial system and the financial players has very little to do with Main Street. And that's the issue. But, you know, it's sort of good that the financial system is still being supported, but it's bad that it's at the expense of Main Street. Happy Robot, thank you so much. Appreciate that. Dimantra says, should I start renting till we see what happens with house prices next year? First time buyer, and we need to move out of home. Yeah, I think I would be slight. Personally, if it were me in your situation, unless you've got an absolutely dying need to buy now, I would wait, because I think you'll see that prices will drop a lot further and you'll have more choice, and you'll also probably be able to get more incentive schemes from the government and things like that. So, yeah, I think there's a good opportunity to rent. Average rentals have dropped in Sydney 20 to 30%, some more, some less, which basically means that you can probably rent somewhere. There's a lot of supply. There's nearly 30,000 properties for rental in around Sydney now. That's the highest it's been for a long time. A lot of choice, low rents, a lot of flexibility. Keep yourself in a flexible state for some time until you see where this comes out is what I'd be doing. And Vanessa says, thank you for the great content and taking time to answer our questions. Good night and keep good health. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And Abby says, thank you very much. Okay. Possible first home grant of $100,000, says Dana. Possibly. You know, it is certainly feasible that we'll see a bigger grant. But, you know, people need to understand, every time you put those grants out there, you distort the market further and you lift prices. So it has real no impact. It just means that a few people get in a bit earlier, but it distorts the market for everybody else. And frankly, it's, in my view, a very myopic strategy. Okay, now I think I've caught up with the questions. So I've got a few questions here. So let me just cover a few of these off. So this is from Kirsten. She thanks me for high frequency of quality information these times. Glad to help. I was wondering, is there any source to track original list prices of property versus ultimate sale prices? Seems like a good lead indicator of what we're going on in the market. Hard to find good data. It is. And with the way that the portals are reporting information at the moment, it's really tough to know what's going on. You can occasionally get historic information at an individual property level if you go to one or two of the information portals, but you can't necessarily get more average information and the translation between the two. What I would say is that I tend to use the realestate.com.au data set rather than the CoreLogic one because it actually provides a bit more information, but it doesn't tell you much about the gap between asking and the final price. The other point there is you can actually look at SQM research. They actually do have some information on asking prices. So you'd have to look at them and then compare them with, for example, realestate.com.au to make some comparisons. That's about the best that I can in terms of making a suggestion on that one. Okay. Now, Phil said, where do you think the RBA and IMF got 6 or 7% in 2021? It's a great question. The GDP rebound that they are suggesting is completely unrealistic, in my view. They've basically assumed a recovery to normal. I see no evidence that we're going to be able to make that happen. And, there's no guarantee that the virus will actually have gone. And in fact, they do say, if you read the paper, if you read the paper, what you'll read there is that they say there are lots of uncertainties and it's just a sort of stake in the ground. I think it's a misleading stake, unfortunately, and I do think that it's likely to be much lower for much longer. Why do you think we can't bounce back? I understand that there is an international factors. What else is preventing the bounce back to business as usual? Good question from MCT. Okay, so the first thing to say is that we already know that we've lost somewhere between 300,000 and 400,000 businesses in Australia now. Most of them small businesses, most of them, sole traders or just small people. They've just basically said, we can't make this work. We can't borrow more money because we've got no way of paying it back. So they've already given up. So businesses, the count of businesses will drop. The second is that some segments of the economy, like, for example, tourism and education, particularly international education, won't come back because whatever we do locally with regard to the virus, the international travel will be locked down for a lot longer. And the point there is that with those sectors off the boil, tourism's a big one, education is a big one, those are really, large momentum elements. Third one is households, which has 50% of GDP, households will have huge overhang here of debt, more debt than ever because people will be borrowing, and they'll have less income because income growth will be very low and people will be working less. So people will have less disposable income available. And finally, some of the industries where we've been fortunate previously with exports to China, for example, resource sector or maybe agriculture, it may be that those become less profitable for us, partly from exchange rate and partly just lack of demand. So I can give you lots of reasons why there's going to be a slowdown. The question is, where's the next growth engine coming from? Where are we going to create new value? And that's what I want to hear from government. I want to hear about their growth engines and the new things they're going to do, not just reducing taxes for businesses further and just doing the same old, same old. We need something really, really different. Unfortunately, I don't think they're capable of it. And that's the thing that I get really cross about because, there is an opportunity, I think, to recraft the local economy and make more stuff here locally and invest in, future-proofing the economy here and creating more capabilities. That could create a very vibrant economy. I just don't think they are up for it, unfortunately. And Aaron says, what rabbits do you think the government has up its sleeve to stimulate the market? Is the 20K superannuation stimulus just putting in the tip? It's possible. there's this $3 trillion in superannuation, and everybody keeps saying it's not productive. They might want to try and make it more productive, so maybe using some of those assets for things. I personally think we should be seeing the construction of a national bank in Australia, a national bank that's going to invest specifically in the things that need to be done here in Australia for the future. So not mortgage lending, but actually investment to business. That's something I would like to see. I'm not sure they're going to do it, but that's what I would want to do. And that would then allow funding to flow directly to create new business momentum, because we have to get business firing again if we're going to get our economy to work properly. And so I'd be looking for that. The other thing I worry about is the government essentially saying, well, we need to actually cut corporate tax, you know, because that was off the agenda for some time. It's likely to be back on the agenda in spades now, and there are people in the current party in power who would love to be able to cut corporate tax to zero or close, you know. It's that bad. But my question then is, well, who's going to pay for all the debt if you do that? And unfortunately, it's you and it's me. It's households who pick up the tab. And I'm not very happy about that, but I suspect that will be part of their policy suite too. Plexus says, please make sure to remind everyone to turn on notifications to get alerts of future streams. YouTube has been shadow banning all streams mentioning the health crisis, so people can't find it. Yeah, I think they may have stopped that now, Plexus, but yeah, just check to make sure that you're getting the alerts. Fact of the matter is that YouTube has been doing some funny things behind the scenes, but so far the ones that I've put up in the last week to 10 days have all worked as I expected, and people have got notifications, but it's worth just checking. Now, Jack says, if Australia is the only place in the world without coronavirus lockdown, does that help the economy? Would that not be a huge boost for Aussie exports? Well, you see, that's my view. And there was an interesting interview with one of the politicians in New Zealand who argued for an Australian-New Zealand virus-free zone, right? So basically you stamp out the virus in Australia, you stamp out the virus in New Zealand, and you create basically that as a sort of a virus-free zone. And then as other people around the world essentially do the same, you can then bolt other people on. Not as stupid as it sounds. Certainly, if we were virus-free, that would actually be a considerable advantage for our exports. But, of course, you would have to stop or control migration in or travel in, because you don't want to bring the virus back in again, and that's the problem. By the way, I've got the view that herd immunity is highly unlikely. So the World Health Organization, I'll get the two muddled up, the World Health Organization came out the other day saying, there's little evidence for long-term antibody for the virus. So basically, you have it for a little while and it disappears. And that means that there may never be herd immunity for the virus. So the only option is to stamp it out. Okay, what else? When will we see realised house price reductions reported, says Eric? Well, of course, it depends on how the indices work. So we're already seeing CoreLogic rate of growth dropping. We're already seeing in some locations significant price falls of individual transactions, 20%, 30% I've seen in some cases. So it is beginning to happen, but it will take some time, and it won't necessarily be uniform across the country, nor indeed across every property type. Units are falling faster than houses. Property right at the top, which had a big spike, has started to fall quite quickly. So I would say give it 3 or 4 months before you start seeing the price falls really come through. Okay, the 10,000 super tax, should we grab it and buy gold and pay off any loans, etc.? Well, interesting question. So depends a bit where your superannuation is lodged at the moment. Remember that if you're drawing out superannuation, the super fund has to cash it out from somewhere. And if you are in stocks and they cash it out now, the chances are that you will have some capital loss on those stocks. It may be less of a problem if you're in deposits. But if you're in deposits, it's not necessarily a bad place to be. So for me, unless you need to pull stuff out of super, my own view is it's probably hardly worth doing. Other people may disagree. I wouldn't buy gold for the reasons I explained earlier on. And, you know, the question is, where else would you put it? The worry I have is, though, that those people who are actually pulling money out of super funds will take some hit, but those people who remain in the funds will actually see a bigger loss over the medium term as more people pull money out, because the funds effectively have to mark to market down all the time as they allow the funds to be exited. So there's a nasty pincer movement here, and I suspect that we will see the value of superannuation drop dramatically. So we were at $3 trillion. I wonder where we'll be, you know, in a few months' time. So, but it's not that straightforward. I wouldn't necessarily do it. Okay. Chris says, in the 1930s, we experienced deflation while on the gold standard. Why will we experience deflation and not inflation with no limit in the printing and no anchor for the currency? Thanks, Nidavas. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate the contribution there. Well, it's because of what I said earlier on. There is certainly, you know, there is an inflationary scenario you could play out, and it's the one you just said, that you throw more money at it, effectively you've got the same value of goods, therefore with more money, same value of goods, you get inflation. So that's certainly one. But that's not what happened in Japan. And Japan is the best example that I've got of the deflationary spiral, the Japanization of the economy. And they've tried for 30 years pretty much now to try and pull the economy around and failed miserably. Their inflation is, you know, nowhere. Prices have dropped. Stock prices really are not performing that well. So Japan is my answer to your question. If we get a Japanese-type situation here, then it goes the other way. And therefore, people may not fully have understood yet why. I also think maybe technology is part of it, that in fact, you know, things can be done more cheaply through automation and all those things. That's part of the puzzle as well. So there's a bunch of different things that are all driving it the same way, I suspect. Oops. Okay, Truth Seeker says, do you see a public bank in the near future? Well, I would love to see one. I'm not sure they will create one, but they should create one. For me, it's a really important strategy with regards to creating the future that we want. I'm looking around the corner because the dog's suddenly woken up. Hello. He's sort of having a look around. So just so you know, you know, you may know that we used to have two dogs. Unfortunately, one of our dogs died the other week, so we're now down to one dog. And our one dog, our three-legged dog, is actually a bit lost. So occasionally he suddenly looks around for his friend and his friend is no longer here. So it's all a bit sad. Okay, now what else have we got? Do you think, this is from Michael, do you think banks will start repossessing homes in the next 12 to 6 months? How bad do you think it will get? No, I think they probably won't in the short term. They've got no reason to, and particularly with all the repayment holidays and those sorts of things. Longer term, they might. All the experience from the US, though, was that there was very little activity in the short term. A lot of people were in the same situation and they ended up essentially not being able to deal with the volume of repossession. So 5 years later, people were still living in their properties where they'd stopped paying the mortgage. So if enough people get into difficulty, it's very tough for the banks to deal with it. On the other hand, we know that in Australia already, banks have been quite pushy in terms of encouraging people to sell when they get into difficulty. And I expect to see that. So there will be effectively a lot of pressure, moral pressure and financial pressure, being brought to bear on people in financial difficulty and recommended to sell rather than them going through formal foreclosure. That's typically what happens in Australia. Thomas said, I overheard talk of investigating flexibility in the workforce and re-energising industrial relations as a solution to employment. Should I be sceptical? I think you should be. I think there's very little real intent to give workers more choice, more power, more flexibility. Unfortunately, we seem to have gone past that and, you know, with the individual workers' contracts and those things. I think we're going to see more of that. And with the gig economy and all of those things, it's all part of the same problem. Okay, where else have we got? What else have we got here? When should we expect helicopter money in Australia, says Eric. Yeah, it's an interesting question. I've argued for some time that we should have gone for the UBI, in other words, universal basic income, give money direct to households rather than giving them through the business community, simply because of the fact that it's going to be quite difficult, I think, to get out of this mess. But I wouldn't be surprised to see direct payments to households later, particularly if this is U-shaped, particularly if we find high levels of unemployment and underemployment. So, yeah, watch this space. Terry, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Yeah, and Rob says, I think the crucial factor between Japanisation and the Australian economy is migration. Sure, I agree with you, but now we've got zero migration because of the, effectively because of the virus, right? There are no people coming into the country. And that's not likely necessarily to change in the short term. So effectively, what that means is that the growth engine that we've had for a generation or two, which is population growth, has gone. And that's my point about what the next growth engine is, right? If it isn't population, what is it? And at the moment, I'm not sure I know. Pichon, thank you very much. Now, this is one from Ella. Would it be a good idea to pull out all my super to buy an investment house and put it into the self-managed super fund? Whoa, can't give you direct specific financial advice, but generally, I'd be careful buying property at the moment. I think prices will fall further. And what you should be doing is checking where your super is invested, right? If it's in, it depends a bit where you are on the age curve as well, but if you're invested in stuff that with high volatility and risk in the current environment, you might want to think about switching to slightly lower risk opportunities. I don't see property as a low risk opportunity at the moment. And the risk, of course, is that you lose capital. And unfortunately, in a price scenario that I'm looking at, you could easily lose 40%. So I'd hold off at the moment from doing that, I think, if it were me. So Ron says, ETH, I think even if Sydney and Melbourne real estate halved in value, that would still be overvalued compared to average yearly wages. Yeah, you're right. So the average income ratio at the moment is about 8 or 9 times in Sydney, right? It used to be 3 to 4 times. So that tells you that we have to see prices cut in half or more just to get back to a pretty standard level. And then we know that incomes are likely to be compressed, not growing over the next 4 to 5 years. So yeah, absolutely right. We're running against the tide here in terms of the value of property. We know it's overvalued. I said earlier on, it's overvalued by at least 40%. And there's very little evidence that I've got to be able to present a reason as to why it should go in rising. It should fall, and it should fall, I think, quite a lot. Cookie says, oil futures price currently minus 577. I assume that's the May contract, so yeah, still negative. Nobody wants oil. I mean, you know, what are you going to do with it? Like I said earlier on, we should create a strategic reserve, perhaps. David says, why does Martin ignore my questions? David, I didn't see your question. So if you ask me the question again, I'll try and get to it. I'm certainly not ignoring deliberately anybody, but you're not using at Walk the World. If you use at Walk the World, just at Walk the World, they're the ones that jump out at me and they're the ones I go to because there are so many other conversations that are going on and it really does make it quite difficult. But if you use at Walk the World, I'll try and get to your question. Okay, great question from CDL. Was it CD1? I'm not sure which. What's your view on the idea of debt jubilee? Of course, Steve Keen and Michael Hudson do recommend the interview that I did with Michael Hudson, who went through the history of debt jubilees and why they're a good idea. Steve Keen is a great believer in debt jubilee, in other words, forgiving loans. We have to find a way out of this highly indebted environment that we're in, and certainly debt jubilee is one way. There are different mechanisms that could be used, but we have to find a way of dealing with too much debt and too high asset values. Maybe we bring both down in some way. Maybe that's a way of dealing with it. Of course, there's always the moral hazard question, which people always throw back at me and say, well, you know, how can it be right that people who basically were given, you know, a free pass with their loan, what about those people who were more prudent? And I agree, there's all sorts of issues to be worked through. But I actually think there's some merit in Steve's ideas of debt jubilee. Okay. Oh, Mickey, thanks very much for some doggy treats. Yes, he's into treats. 14-year-old three-legged labradoodle called Winston is our sole doggy now. So he's now become top dog. Okay, let's have a look. D says, are we likely to see higher taxes in the future? And to repay that, yeah, somewhere along the line. So there's an interesting question. Is this debt ever going to be repaid? So there are some schools of thought who basically says governments can run up big deficits and not worry about it, particularly if they're creating value in the economy and creating growth and all those good things. The trouble is the debts we've run up are not creating value in the economy and not creating growth. They're effectively trying to insulate and protect the current economy that we've got. So the problem I have is we end up with this big amount of debt that ultimately will have to be repaid one way or the other. And I'm afraid I'm a slightly more old-fashioned economist here, thinking that debt ultimately needs to be repaid. But if you, again, if you go to Michael Hudson, he'd say, no, actually, there are arguments for as to why debt should not be repaid. It should be written down. I recommend that video. Jack says, what level of falls do you expect in regional areas under your 65% scenario? It depends a bit. If I'm looking at Wollongong and Newcastle, I'm probably around 20%, not because they haven't really risen as much. Other regional areas where there's been even less growth, there might be even the less less of a drop. But I have to tell you that we are looking at significantly distressed households in some of those regional areas. So I wouldn't be surprised to see a lot of distressed properties for sale. And that would take the property prices further down, potentially. Jishu says, thanks for your quality content. Keep going. I'm keep going. And looking at that, we're at 928. So I won't be keep going for that much longer. Population growth needs to end. Yeah, I tend to agree with that statement. The fact is that we've grown the economy through more people, but the quality of life has been degraded. Look at Sydney, Melbourne, other centres. We need to find an alternative formulation. I don't believe all of this high-rise development, you know, often in poorly constructed high-rise, is good. It's not a good long-term strategy. So I will be looking for a different strategy, and part of that is to have a sensible size population, sensible growth. But then I go back to my point, if you don't use the population as the mechanism to grow, then what else do you use? And we don't have an answer to that, although I outlined a couple of ideas earlier on. Craig says, hardest working man on the tube. Thanks, Martin. Yeah, thanks, appreciate that. It is a bit like that. You know, always plenty to talk about, always plenty to do, but actually I love doing it. And particularly now with the lockdown, you know, it's actually quite good because I can just basically just do this. So it's quite good, really. All right. Now, this is from... I can't read that one from here. Mattins, I think. My friend wants to rent an apartment in Sydney CBD. Rental prices don't reflect new reality on rental websites. What percentage discount should he ask, in my opinion? Well, I've said to a couple of people, go in at 30 and start from there, and you might end up with 20 or 15. Somebody did that the other day and ended up with a very healthy 10%, but with a promise of another 10% later. So, yeah, I would say 30% in the round. There are so many properties for rent in and around that area at the moment, and huge supply, not much demand. So, yeah, go in there, I was what I do. Sitting in lockdown, and the wife says, thanks for taking me away for the last few hours. That's from a big town. Great. Okay. Could you please elaborate on how you think Japan managed to avoid inflation despite government growing towards 250%? We have a long way to go before things get that bad here. Yeah, that's binary agenda. Well, they didn't try. I mean, they basically tried to drive inflation. They had an inflation target. They basically stimulated the economy. They did QE. But essentially, they got to the point where there was nothing more that could be done with the money they were creating, and that's been the problem. So there's a point beyond which creating more money doesn't go anywhere because it doesn't do anything. and that's basically what they've done. So that's the real problem, I think. Just looking down the list, see what else we've got. I'm going to run out of smoke quite soon now. I think I've missed. Once again, I haven't been able to do these questions. I've got a bunch of questions, which I will make a separate show. I keep saying that, and then try to use them next time. But I've got 2 hours worth of questions probably. So I'll make a separate show for those people who sent me the questions beforehand. I promise. All right. This is from the Fizzer saying, "Do you think the EU will last, and how will the impact on future crises to come? Are we similar to Ireland?" So the EU, I think the EU is in difficulty. As I described in one of my other posts, Italy's got a major issue. Basically, you've got the northern guys wanting to not lend money to the southern guys. You've got the southern guys who need it. The EU is in all sorts of distress. The ECB has taken rates really low. They're doing QE. I'm not sure it's going to survive in its current form. It's my honest opinion. And are we like Ireland? To an extent, yes, but not quite the same, because, of course, they were part of the EU, so their currency was not independent. Ours is. So it gives us a bit more latitude, but nevertheless, many of the things that they did, we are doing, and I wouldn't be surprised to see somewhat similar. Matthew says, thanks for your answer. 30% was my guess also. Oh, well, there you go. We'll see. We'll compare notes a bit down the track. My cat just turned 16. Is she eligible for the pension, says Cookie? Well, good question. Yeah, I don't know. That sounds a pretty good age. We lost our cat at 14, so that's good. So 16's a pretty good age. Our doggy at 14 is amazing. So, 14 is pretty good. Okay. Love your work. As you mentioned, the fiat price of real estate in Japan is accurate. However, the gold price is up 155% since the lows of 2008. There's the opportunity. Yeah, maybe. We'll see. I'd argue that perhaps the gold price there is influenced by what's happening to gold prices in other parts of the world. But I won't necessarily go into that at the moment. All right, so there you go. I pretty much have covered the questions. Cookie Boy says, Sydney regional listings, 18,416 steady over the last couple of months. Rentals up from 25K to 30,000. Yeah, we're seeing loads of rentals. All right, so let me just then go back to my final slides and just to round this show off. So just if you want more information, go to the DFA blog. Tons of stuff there. And you can also contact me if you've got a question. If you want to contact me directly, you can contact me via the DFA blog through the little app at the bottom of the screen. You can also support our work via Patreon. And I have to tell you that I've had a few people withdraw from Patreon because of the financial issues. There are ways to support us through Patreon. You can go at different levels. This is a way just to continue to support our work on an ongoing basis. It is greatly appreciated. You get access to additional content as well and a lot of other things. You can also make a one-off donation via PayPal, and people have been doing that. Appreciate that. Again, every contribution we get, whether it's from Super Chat or via PayPal or Patreon, just covers the costs of what we do. We don't make any profit out of this at the end of the day. Or indeed Bitcoin. So, despite what I said about Bitcoin, people have asked for a QR code, so there's a QR code there. I've also got this design, which is my Intelligent Insights logo, and that's available on some Merc. I'll probably change some of that down the track, but the DFA store is up and running, and a few people have gone there, so that's just something you might or might not. The various colours don't show up very well. I might change those with actually various colour choices other than white. It's just that that's the ones that defaulted to. Top hits just into shows you should look at. My conversation with George today, I recommend that. Really interesting conversation. George and I record a show for his channel, about an hour's long. That'll be up soon as well. What the Fed, that tickled a few people because I got really a bit frustrated with the Fed. I recommend that video. Tarek and I continue to have great conversation. Tarek's a great find, by the way. He's got a really interesting point of view, so we continue to discuss with him. And Edwin and I have made more shows quite recently. I've got a conversation running with George, not George Gamma, another George, and we're going to be doing another episode in our Alice in Wonderland series, or Down the Rabbit Hole, or whatever you want to call it, shortly. And then we've also got John Adams and I on the other channel on IOTP. The Australian economy has been completely destroyed within 4 weeks. That was part one. We're going to do a part two, and the part two will be sort of coming up in the next few days. We're going to record it tomorrow, and we've figured out how to do it with the technical challenge that John has. So there we go. Okay, so the next show will be on the 5th of May. I'm going to run in another one in 2 weeks' time. That's the day that the Reserve Bank meets next. So hopefully that will be interesting. And the truth is that there'll be a lot more to talk about. I will have some updated modelling. I'll have the next mortgage stress data. I'll have the next COVID data. And I've also got some other work being done in the SME sector. So I'll basically drive some of the information from the SME sector into the conversation too, because I think that's really, really important. Okay, so there you go. That's pretty much it. I really appreciate the time you've spent with me tonight. And here we are at 9:38, still going. What donation method results in you getting the most? Who skims the least? Actually, PayPal is the quickest way. Patreon takes a bit more, so that's the way I would do it. Or if you want to use PayID, if you're in Australia, just send me a message via the DFA blog, and PayID doesn't cost anything to do at all. Okay, Cookie Boy says, I personally still love the two-week concept. Yeah, well, we'll keep going with 2 weeks at the moment. There's more people around at home. There's so much going on. And it also means that on these nights, I don't have to make my separate show, because basically I do my show real time. So it's I love doing the live stuff, because it's a really great to interact with everybody. So I want to say thank you for your time tonight. Thank you for the thoughts and opinions. If I missed your question, I'm sorry. Send it to me again. Send it via the DFA blog and I'll get to it. For those people who sent me questions in beforehand, I will now record a separate show, because I have got so many questions to answer. But nevertheless, we did touch quite a few of them tonight. So take care, keep safe, and we will see you in 2 weeks' time. Martin Orst from Digital Finance Analytics signing off. We'll see you next time.